oficial de la casa ocupa donde vive.
Aquí viven 8 personas y vivimos común, entonces compartimos la cocina, tenemos un cuarto de estar donde comemos juntos y cada uno tiene su propio cuarto. Todo el mundo aquí está trabajando en algún oficio distinto y haciendo nuestros proyectos. Lo que nos importa mucho y es también una base de la ocupación es hacer algo social con nuestros espacios. Entonces muchos ocupas tienen algún espacio social donde, por ejemplo, un bar donde la gente puede tomar un café barato, porque aquí en el centro de Amsterdam solo se puede tomar un café que vale más que 2 euros. Nosotros, por ejemplo, en nuestra casa tenemos un espacio de producción para imprimir en camisetas o carteles que todo el mundo puede usar si quiere.
Aún con la criminalización de la ocupación, Katinka estima que el movimiento Ocupa continuará.
¿Qué vamos a hacer? Si van a prohibir la ocupación, seguramente vamos a seguir ocupando porque no hay una solución para la necesidad de viviendas.
Llegamos al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a todos los medios comunitarios que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Javier Benítez y del director del proyecto, Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPad o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Este es Libre Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM. Me llamo Roberto Norse. I'm Robert Norse, and this is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. And hereafter, I'm going to continue in English. My apologies to those speaking Spanish. Someday, perhaps. We'll see. For the next 2 hours, you're going to be with me, I hope, on the air. And if you want, actually, you can be on the air, too, by giving a call. 831-427-3772 is the call-in number. This is a talk show and a kind of a rant show as well. I do a lot of ranting around the issues of civil rights for poor people and homeless civil rights in Santa Cruz, or what we should have for those civil rights but don't. I'm going to be having a special guest, two of them actually, one at 6:30. That's going to be attorney David Beauvais of Berkeley. He's going to be covering the recent Ninth Circuit Court decision in the Norse versus Santa Cruz City Council case, which I lost, or at least I've lost at this level, and we'll be talking about that. That's the famous Heil-Krohn case, for those of you who have been following it for the last 7 years as it's wound its way up and down the courts. David Beauvais is one of the two attorneys who's been covering it. We'll be talking to him. Also be talking with Tracy Heron. I believe her name now is also Tracy Reed. She's remarried or taken a new name. She's an attorney up in Arcata, California, who's going to be talking about Tad Robinson, or just Tad as he likes to call himself, who's gone to jail and is doing a hunger strike around issues that concern the rights of people to have access to the Board of Supervisors and other public bodies. And Tad himself is a homeless activist concerned with publicizing and defending the rights of poor people up there. He's been in jail since the last couple weeks in October, and she'll be talking about that case and about sleeping bans up there. This is also I also am going to give you some quick updates on the Robert Facer and John Keeley trials. Those are the trials in the courtroom of Kim Baskett that happened on Tuesday and Wednesday. And I'm actually going to be going into greater depth about those trials on Sunday when I do a longer show in the morning. I'll be playing some of the trials for broadcast, and I will be talking about the issues involved. And finally, tonight at 7 o'clock, for those of you who are interested in the downtown area, there is a hearing of the Planning Commission, which sounds like pretty dry stuff. But in this case, one of the items on the Planning Commission agenda is a ban on all medical marijuana facilities other than the two that are currently open, Greenway and Ken Sampson's Club. This is something I warned was likely to be happening as this city and other cities around the state seek to kind of rationalize and justify their anti-marijuana paranoia and prejudice by claiming that there are really unspoken public safety concerns. Why marijuana should be any more closely regulated than alcohol or cigarettes or pharmaceutical drugs is nowhere explained, except that it's something that a lot of people, including a lot of police agencies, want to keep illegal. And your very liberal city council voted unanimously to begin this process in June, to continue it in July with a moratorium on two applications for new clubs that had come in, marijuana distribution clubs. And now they're trying to make sure that no other clubs will open. This is coming up before the Planning Commission at 7 o'clock tonight at Santa Cruz City Hall, Santa Cruz City Council Chambers. And I encourage folks to go and check it out. I would be there myself probably, except I'm here instead, and I've got radio business to attend to. I'd hope to get an activist to go and video the whole thing, but that has not been possible so far. But who knows? Maybe somebody will step into the breach. One of the problems is that the audio equipment that the city has been defective for the last 8 months and has not been repaired. I've gotten excuse after excuse from the Public Works Commission and the city clerk's office. It seems to me the bottom line is that they don't give a shit. It's not a high priority for them. They don't care if you get a chance to have access to these commission meetings, which are really... This is the committee that really considers the issue. These are appointed by the city council, the members of the planning commission, the members of the other bodies like the Public Works Commission or the Downtown Commission. And often these commissions are skipped. So, for example, when you got the smoking ban, it didn't go to the Downtown Commission, even though it largely concerns the downtown. You know, when you got the anti-homeless ordinances that concerned expanding forbidden zones downtown where you can't sit, can't spare change, can't peacefully perform, or essentially use public space in ways that involve political tabling, then that was supposed to go through the Downtown Commission, but no, Mayor Matthews did not allow that. Last time, of course, when she let a measure go through the Downtown Commission, it took considerably longer since a couple of the commission members were a little concerned, for example, that Ryan Coonerty's parking lot panic law that has now makes it illegal for you to read a book in your car in any of the 20-odd downtown public parking lots and garages. Some members of the Downtown Commission had some doubts about that, and indeed the ACLU actually got itself into gear for, I don't want to say the first time in memory, but on a rare example of our local ACLU actually defending the civil liberties of people in Santa Cruz, as distinguished from running around panhandling for the national ACLU. But anyway, these commissions, one of them meeting tonight, the Planning Commission, is considering an ordinance, an amendment to Title 24 of the Santa Cruz Municipal Code. It's the it modifies standards for medical marijuana dispensaries. And the background, as presented in the agenda report, is that on February 25th, 2009, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced in a press conference he was ending federal marijuana raids. Now, of course, he didn't, and they didn't end prosecutions. So this is a misleading statement. It was misleading 4 months ago when the same staff people used this as an excuse to pass an emergency ordinance for a moratorium on medical marijuana dispensaries. People in the staff members and those who are backing this seem to have this irrational, heavy fear of medical marijuana dispensaries, which is unjustified and also sets the scene for a large black market. But let's continue with the justification for the proposed changes. The proposed changes essentially ban any kind of new dispensaries in the city of Santa Cruz. They do allow for two grow houses to be added to the two existing dispensaries, as I understand it. Although I haven't really carefully read the text of this. I'm getting my reading to some extent from the Sentinel and to some extent from the agenda report. And again, you can go check this out yourself at 7 o'clock at the City Council Chambers. Go down there and hear what's going on. Maybe you can give a call and report back to Free Radio what's going on. 427-3772 is our call-in number here. If you want to give a call and let us know. Concerns have been raised, these are the passive tense, the staff report continues, regarding the inadequacy of current regulations to address the potential number of permit applications. It doesn't say who's raising the concerns. It says concerns have been raised. Naturally, I guess they don't want you to know, the police department and, I don't know, certain conservative anti-drug groups are raising it, or who knows, maybe Greenway and Ken Sampson's club want to keep a monopoly on what they're doing. I doubt it, but, you know, it's possible. But we're not being advised as to who these mysterious people are who are raising these concerns. A number of cities have established moratoriums on medical marijuana dispensaries because of a considerable increase in persons wishing to establish such facilities in their communities. Why would that be a problem? I mean, it's been pointed out by even such conservative sources as the Santa Cruz Sentinel topics or comments, which is the kind of the dialogue that goes on after a Santa Cruz Sentinel story goes online. People start discussing it and leaving comments on it. Usually they're very, sometimes racist, certainly anti-homeless, a lot of attacks on homeless activists if it's about a homeless issue. Generally a very conservative kind of quality, but there are a lot of people in Santa Cruz who understand kind of basically and feel very strongly that marijuana generally should not be illegal, that it's like alcohol prohibition in a similar way, produces a huge black market, vast expense, corruption in the police department, and criminalizes a lot of people. It's a juggernaut that continues to grow every year. The number of marijuana arrests grows in spite of the wonderful Obama or what the wonderful Santa Cruz City Council, however you want to, who are your progressive heroes of the moment? They're not doing anything about it. In fact, they're the ones who are pushing for this they pushed for the moratorium, or they voted for it in this last summer. The Santa Cruz City Council did, unanimously. And they're also, I'm afraid, likely, unless there's a huge outpouring of objections, likely to pass a complete ban on dispensaries. So what happened was, first on June 23rd, the City Council established a 45-day moratorium on medical marijuana dispensaries, a pause, killing two applications, in essence. One guy withdrew his application, the other guy is still trying to apply. And then on July 28th, a month later, they expanded it to a six-month moratorium so that the staff could come up with, could cook up this report, it looks like. Here's what they're suggesting. They're going to modify definition of medical marijuana dispensaries to allow on-site cultivation as well as sale of clones, but only for the two dispensaries that currently exist. They'll eliminate cultivation as a separate allowable use elsewhere, so that's going to allow, you're not going to be able to cultivate at all as a separate allowable use. And I'm not sure if that is for probably for your own use. I think they'd be hard put to stop it, but maybe they're going to stop that too. It's not clear to me. They'll limit the dispensary area used for cultivation to 2,000 square feet, require solar panels, limit the number of dispensaries in the city to a maximum of two, add residential zone districts to the 600-foot setback sitting criteria, or siting criteria, making it even more restrictive. It took 5 years. I want to remind anybody listening, 5 years between 2000 and 2005 when these restrictive regulations were put in to have a medical marijuana dispensary open. And that required a variance. That required a special alteration of the laws. Now they're going to make the laws even more restrictive. Is there some indication that marijuana, whether it grows hair on your palms, defeats politicians in office, offends the police department, perhaps? Maybe that's the problem. I don't know. And a couple other things. They'll require access to dispensary financial records and clean up the language. Then there's an analysis in this report. And I don't really, I hope people go to this, but I don't know that now is the time for me to run through the report is an interesting report, and I encourage people who go there to read it over. The basic claim that they have is that if you consider the number of dispensaries in Berkeley, Oakland, Santa Rosa, and Santa Cruz, per population, they're trying to cut down the number of dispensaries to afford with the number of dispensaries in those cities that have been limited. In Berkeley, they have 3 for 105,000 people. In Oakland, they have 4 for 420,000. Santa Rosa, they have 2 for 161,000. And they're saying, look how liberal they are. We have 2 for 60,000 people in Santa Cruz. We have a caller, so I'm going to interrupt my thoughts here. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hi, Robert. John.
Hey, John. What's new?
Hi. I was just listening to your talk on medical marijuana.
Uh-huh.
My personal thought is that I think we're just going about it all wrong. I heard something the other day in trying to get it medical. I think it should be legal, and like beer and wine, we can grow some at home for our personal use and things of that nature. I heard something on, I think it was on a public radio station, maybe NPR, and they talked to this guy that was saying, yes, we have to research it. We have to know the controlled dosages of a given amount of marijuana. It's getting too wrapped up in the bureaucratic bowl of it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I have no disagreement with you, John. In fact, as you know, there's both a legislative measure by, I guess, Tom Ammiano of San Francisco to decriminalize or legalize it statewide, and there's also three initiatives that are being circulated to be put on the ballot next election in 2010. But yeah, the trouble is that what's happening now is we're stuck with a situation where one's access to marijuana, if you're doing it legally and you're not growing your own, it has to be through the medical root, and that's too bad because it makes for some falsifications, it makes for, you know, medical patients are played off against non-medical patients, and that's bad. But the reality of the prohibition, and perhaps you agree with me on this, is even worse. The kind of waste of resources and the criminalization that happens to people, and the misappropriation of police time and energy too. So my concern is that people get down to this meeting tonight at 7 o'clock and say, why are you putting a moratorium or a freeze on medical marijuana dispensaries when this is going to be the only legal access? What, do you just want to provide a monopoly for the two existing dispensaries? I mean, anyway, that's kind of my advocacy position.
Well, I think that the bureaucratic input wants to control everything. And it's so frustrating that if, let's say, you and I were, we went out to the city building down there, and we went down, sat the lawn, cut some of the lawn, and dried it and smoked it, we wouldn't be arrested. It's just the whole thing of trying to control escaping this reality, for lack of a better term. I don't want to do it with beer or wine
Are you a pothead, John? Let's be honest now. Are you
somewhat?
Oh, for heaven's sake! So you're just an addict, obviously, right?
Yeah, that's it. And it, you know, the whole thing with what they tried to say back in the '60s, you know, you'll never amount to anything. And well, let's see, how does that play out now? You could be a gold medal winner. California's governor. You could be president.
Right. I mean, but let me interrupt you because, see, my problem is whenever I hear these arguments, I agree with them. I'm just wondering, what can we do tonight? What can we do now in Santa Cruz to at least expand our freedoms in this regard and beat back this crazy prejudice that is, sucking up millions of dollars, probably tens of millions of dollars, and ruining
lives.
Hundreds of thousands of lives, and, at least the country at large. And my answer to that is we have to attack it at the local level. The city council and its staff is pressuring to essentially increase marijuana prohibition in Santa Cruz. The community has to say no, is how I feel about it.
Yeah, I agree.
But, I mean, more broadly, obviously it needs to be legalized. I mean, I'd like to see people come out on the streets and smoke it, or if you don't want to smoke it because you don't want to violate the smoking ban, for heaven's sake, eat it or wave it around. I mean, I think there has to be some kind of direct action by the community, not waiting for permission to have the liberties that you have to assert your liberties, and you have to do so in a way that is reasonable, frankly forceful, and in a, in a
and a kind of a joint solidarity, so people support each other. And of course, it's a difficult equation, you know.
Yeah. If you don't exercise your democratic right by default, you live in a dictatorship.
Right, or you live in a medieval society with standards which are dictated by ignorance and fear, and folks who have their own limited kind of pseudo-religious agenda on this issue, which I think individuals, if they don't want to smoke marijuana and they don't want it, in their children's playgrounds, that's fine. But get your nose out of our lives, you know. I mean, that's always been the issue, and unfortunately, we're going to have to fight for that right, I'm afraid.
Yes, we are. I want that bumper sticker, or I want to make a bumper sticker. Government, stop trying to protect me from myself.
Hear, hear. All right, well, thank you, John.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And at least thank you, John, for calling in. I appreciate your giving your thoughts on this. Calling number is 427-3772. I'm going to read now from, before we finish up this public, the Planning Commission meeting that's happening at 7 o'clock today to essentially pass a resolution from the staff, which claims that because three cities which have made the mistake of limiting their marijuana distribution centers out of similar fears, but without any real concrete evidence that there was no crime associated with our medical marijuana centers. There's a lot of profiteering, probably, that's associated with it, and that's too bad. But the more competition, presumably, the less profiteering. That's the free market system, right? You know, I don't know how that actually works out in practice in this kind of situation, but I don't think less competition, unless you have some special subsidies. And that's not a part of this recommendation. There was supposed to be an Office of Compassionate Use, which Mike Rotkin, one of our incoming mayor, our current vice mayor, passed in 2005. But, of course, he had that conditional on the federal government's legalizing marijuana, which is like saying, you know, when heaven comes, then we'll allow people their rights here, instead of saying we're going to give people their rights here regardless of what these idiots in Washington are trying to do. And it's a pity that we don't have that perspective here now, because the Office of Compassionate Use was an idea of actually providing poor people with the medical marijuana they need without having to, you know, jump through all the hoops that are required. They have a couple of studies that they did, a market study for a medical marijuana dispensary, actually, which was presented, I think, by one of the applicants whose application was frozen. And I have the study here, but frankly I have not read it in very carefully. It is again available online. All this stuff is, if you go to the city council website, the city website, you can find this medical marijuana market study. The only argument being made is not that it's a crime problem, but that most of the people who buy marijuana are outside the city limits, 3/4 of them. So therefore, it's somehow you don't need any more marijuana dispensaries. There's no indication of the needs of people who are inside the city or in the county. There's no indication of, you know, whether the same standard should be applied to alcohol establishments, pharmaceutical establishments, or for that matter, clothing establishments. Are we going to say that unless clothing establishments, we're going to start limiting all these other establishments because most of their business comes from outside the city? I mean, it's a bizarre, and obviously it's an argument that's tailored to look reasonable, that it has no real rational basis other than a fear and a hatred of marijuana use, or an undue apprehension about marijuana use, which has always been the case, frankly, among police agencies, with a few exceptions. And I'm afraid that's the case with our police agency and our staff. If you want to look at cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles that actually have many medical marijuana dispensaries, I guess San Francisco did freeze the medical marijuana dispensaries at some point, too, but they had many more. And I'm not aware that Los Angeles has done any such thing. But the question as to what's the rationale and justification for doing that is something that I don't see the basis for, and I tend to presume that it has to do with prejudice, fear, and somebody's anti-marijuana agenda. So get down to City Council at 7 o'clock if you want to deal with this issue, if you want to hear about it. It's not being broadcast anywhere. It's going to be hard to hear the hearing later because, as I mentioned before, the equipment, at least as of a month ago, was not working in a way that allowed the city to make copies of tapes to be available in the library or to be purchased by people. The only thing they could tell you is, well, if you set up an appointment, you can hear the original tape, which I have not tried yet because it's a pain in the ass, and I've got other things I wanted to do, but I may have to do it for this hearing just because I want to, I guess, hear what's going down. I suspect this is going to be fast-tracked under the next city council meeting, but who knows what thrills Cynthia Matthews and Mike Rotkin have in store for us on this subject. That's our mayor and vice mayor. Actually, Rotkin, as I mentioned before, is the incoming mayor. Now, I'm going to be having a guest on in about 6 minutes, David Beauvais, or whenever he calls in, who is an attorney who for 7 years, along with Kate Wells, has taken the case of, well, stopping the city council from declaring that expressing an unpopular opinion at city council is disruptive, and thereby banning the person from the city council on pain of arrest and arresting the person if she or he doesn't leave. That happened to me after city council muzzled Susan Zeman, who was a peace activist, who simply wanted her 2 minutes at the microphone, 3 minutes for oral communications. She was threatened with arrest if she didn't leave the podium after she had noticed another man being dragged off. She tried to draw the attention of the chair to how absurd this was or how repressive. She was threatened with arrest, and as she left the podium, I raised my right or my left hand in a pseudo-Nazi salute to the city council, indicating you're acting like a bunch of fascists. It was silent, didn't say anything, lasted about 2 or 3 minutes. The mayor didn't notice it, but a council member did, Council Member Fitzmaurice, and he said, "Oh, you made a Nazi salute, you must be removed from the chambers," and I said, "No, it's my right to be here," and sat down. They recessed the meeting, had me arrested, had me taken to jail, held for 5 hours, and then finally dropped all the charges because I don't think they could have found a jury to convict me, though I could be wrong. I've seen weirder convictions. But the notion that a council member can disrupt a meeting, as Council Member Fitzmaurice did, because he didn't like my Nazi, silent, brief Nazi salute, and blame the person who he is disrupting the meeting for, in order to target that person as the disrupting cause, is pretty outrageous. Fitzmaurice wanted to apply a standard of decorum to the Santa Cruz City Council. And while I suppose there might be some things which are so indecorous as to be really disruptive because they distract everybody's attention for an extended period of time, what I did was not. And that's why for 7 years we've been fighting to make it clear that city council members cannot simply declare a person's behavior disruptive because they don't like it and have that person arrested if they don't leave the council. That is not a good thing. Unfortunately, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, two members of it, did not agree. And they have affirmed the dismissal of our lawsuit against the city of Santa Cruz. The reasons that they did, well, they claimed that, first of all, I never even had a trial on this issue, so I was still trying to have a trial. The judge kept quashing the trial, suggesting that the city council members were immune because they were acting reasonably on this situation, although I don't think it's reasonable in any way to suggest that a fleeting silent gesture is disruptive enough to ban a person from a public meeting, which is the basis, really the basic democratic process. I'm viewing the kind of thumbing through this Norris versus City of Santa Cruz decision. They don't really, the argument that they have, they claim that the salute didn't have anything to do with the message that I was making, but simply condemned the efforts of the mayor to enforce the rules of the meeting. It condemned the conduct of the mayor, on this situation. So it obviously had content. I mean, I can't see why they didn't see that. It's pretty clear. And they claimed I was in cahoots with other people, which I wasn't, and there was no evidence that I was. The dissent, however, is very interesting. It reads as follows. The person who agreed that I should be given my day in court and allowed to prove that the city council violated my rights and presumably should be prevented from violating other people's rights in the same way. What is clear under our case law that local public officials conducting public meetings can restrict speech at such meetings according to subject matter, duration, and method. It is equally clear that public officials may not restrict speech according to the viewpoint of the speaker. In order to avoid any constitutional problems in a prior appeal, we construed the rules of the Santa Cruz City Council to prescribe only disruptive conduct. That limitation on what conduct the council rules prescribe is the law of this case. Yet the record supports the inference that the mayor and the members of the Santa Cruz City Council excluded Norris from the 2002 meeting because they disagreed with the views he expressed by giving his silent Nazi salute. It is uncontroverted that Norris's Nazi salute lasted only a second or two, and in the course of rendering the salute, Norris uttered no word or other sound. He was silent. It is also undisputed that the council permits silent visual speech, such as the displaying of signs at its meetings, so long as such speech does not block the view of or otherwise interfere with other meeting attendees. Thus, the salute comported with the council's rule permitting silent nonverbal messages at the council meeting. That it was not itself disruptive is evidenced by the fact that the mayor was not even aware of it. He continued with his reading of announcements until Councilmember Fitzmorris called his attention to it. And as the video demonstrates, no member of the audience reacted to Norris's silent salute. Drawing all reasonable inferences in Norris's favor, as we must, I submit that there is no way to conclude that as a matter of law, Norris's conduct in rendering a fleeting silent Nazi salute was disruptive. He says, at least I deserve a trial on the issue. They can't sort of shut me down before giving me a trial. The other two judges thought they could just shut me down without the trial. The judge continues, this is Judge Tashima writing his dissent. In fact, a close reading of the majority opinion shows that it does not hold that Norris's conduct was itself disruptive. Thus, there was no justification for the mayor to eject Norris from the meeting for being disruptive. On the contrary, the record clearly supports the inference that Norris was ejected because the mayor and council disagreed with and intensely and overtly disliked his viewpoint. The portion of the district court's ruling quoted by the majority admits as much. First, the district court noted that the mayor was suddenly faced with a meeting that had been interrupted by an offended council member. It then notes the council's hostility to Norris's viewpoint. The mayor also knew that two council members in the previous months had expressed to Norris their abhorrence of his Nazi gestures. Further, as the district court also noted, when Norris made his Nazi salute gesture at past council meetings, he was warned that council members found the gesture to be offensive and that he would be removed from the meeting if he engaged in such conduct again. Thus, there is ample evidence in the record to support a finding that Norris was removed because of his viewpoint, because council members detested being characterized as acting Nazi-like. The majority attempts to elide the point by sidetracking the issue. It says that Norris's action was in support of the disruption that had just occurred, that the mayor was acting in good faith to enforce the council rules, that Norris's Nazi salute could reasonably have been interpreted as intended to support and to further the disruption that had just occurred in the room. Disruption was the police removing Michael Tomasi from the area because he continued speaking beyond his time. But Norris's speech cannot be suppressed because of the actions of others. See Tinker versus Des Moines, holding that black armbands worn by high school students in protest of the Vietnam War were not disruptive, and they could not be suppressed on account of the fact that the armbands might cause others to react in disruptive ways. Nor is Norris's intent relevant, so long as his speech comports with the council's rules, as it did. In sum, the district court erred in holding as a matter of law that the mayor and council's actions in ejecting Norris from the 2002 meeting for rendering a silent Nazi salute did not violate his First Amendment rights. It could only do so by drawing all inferences against Norris, as the majority does. Alternately, the majority further holds that even if, in retrospect, we were to hold that Norris's First Amendment rights were violated, it would not have been clear to a reasonable person in the mayor and council's position that the ejection was unlawful. That's what the majority claims, but Tashima dissents, and he says, this holding also is just plain wrong. Our case law had clearly established 12 years before that speech at a municipal meeting could not be suppressed unless it was actually disruptive. And we have a caller. Hi there, you're on Free Radio. Hello?
Robert.
Hey, could this be Attorney David Beauvais?
It is indeed.
All right, well, let's see if we can pump up your mic here. So I've been reading, I don't know, have you been listening to this online, perhaps?
No, I haven't been in a place to do that.
Well, I've reached the, I'm reading the Tashima dissent, the one of the three justices who said, in essence, the only one who said that my behavior at the city council meeting in 2002 was not disruptive, or at least based on the evidence, it couldn't be presumed to be disruptive. We had to presume it wasn't based upon the fact that the justices were just considering whether to allow us to have a trial. You were the attorney in this case for the last 7 years. Do you want to take over from here?
Well, I mean, I think what people need to do is look at the videotape and see whether or not they think it's disruptive. We've always argued that it wasn't. In fact, it wasn't even really noticed by hardly anybody except council member Fitzmaurice, who then objected to it and asked that that you be excluded, not because you had disrupted the council, but because you had sullied the dignity of the body, you know, by making this Nazi salute. So, you know, the way that he complained about it wasn't that you were disruptive, but that you were hurting his feelings, and that he was offended by your conduct.
Let me play devil's advocate here. Couldn't it be said that when Fitzmaurice, I guess Fitzmaurice was not the mayor at this time, but he'd been mayor the previous year, and he had when mayor he had warned me that I use the gesture sparingly, but on several occasions I have used it in the past or had used it before, and when I used it, he told me if you do that again you'll be ejected. Now, perhaps Fitzmaurice's statement could be construed as a rule, and then my behavior in raising my arm anyway could be construed as a violation of the rules.
Well, you know, what the Ninth Circuit said before your case was that rule violations were not enough. Rule violations had to result in a disruption of the meeting. And that's not what happened here. You didn't disrupt the meeting. So even if that had been a rule violation, they would not have had cause to eject you from the meeting, and they certainly would not have had cause to arrest you for violating Penal Code Section 403, which prohibits people from disrupting public meetings. Because the way that section's been interpreted by the California Supreme Court is that the disruption has to be substantial. And here, there's no disruption at all, much less a substantial disruption that would make it a crime for you to do what you did.
Now, has that changed because of this ruling? Do we now have a new standard in the Ninth Circuit, which covers nine states, that there needn't be a substantial disruption, just an opinion by the chair that there's a rule violation or something?
Yeah, I don't see a lot of clarity in the majority ruling. But what I do seem to glean from it is that if you commit an act that encourages or supports another person's disruption, even though your act in and of itself is not disruptive, in other words, you do the act with the intent of supporting someone else's disruption, that you can be ejected from the meeting. And then the other part of the majority opinion rules that them singling you out for special treatment was not a viewpoint discrimination. So, and that's where the dissent, you know, obviously doesn't agree with the majority on both of those points. One, the dissent says there was no disruption, and two, says that there was at least some evidence in the record, enough to go to a jury, that there was viewpoint discrimination in expelling you from the meeting. I think what everyone's dancing around in this case is that they don't like Nazi salute.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan.
I remember Judge Schroeder. They're called judges on the Ninth Circuit. They're not called justices. Uh-huh. Judge Schroeder,
mm-hmm.
or as they often say themselves, there is no justice in the Ninth Circuit. Judge Schroeder, at oral argument, says that the Nazi salute is offensive. I remember her making that comment.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but the thing about, you know, the First Amendment is that it allows for offensive speech, because speech that's not offensive doesn't need constitutional protection. It's only speech that offends that we need to protect.
So again, I didn't read the majority opinion. I probably should have, and I probably should read it more carefully, because it's what is now law in the Ninth Circuit, right?
Yeah, until we can get it turned overturned, which we hope to do.
Maybe you should talk a little bit about that before we go any further. What steps are next to be taken?
You basically have four steps ahead of you that potentially can be taken. The first step is to ask this three-judge panel to reconsider their decision, and maybe you could get one of these judges to change position. That would likely be Judge Schroeder, because Judge O'Scanlan has been resolutely against you from the beginning. The second step is to ask for the entire, what they call an en banc review, which is an 11-judge panel of the active judges of the Ninth Circuit who can then take up the case and make a different decision. If you get to that point where they accept it and they hear it, then you can ask them to rehear it. And the next stage beyond that would be to petition for certiorari in the United States Supreme Court.
The very liberal Roberts Court.
Yes, that one. So those are the steps.
That's three steps, it looks like. But, yeah. Okay.
Petition for hearing to the panel, petition for en banc review, ask the en banc court to review its decision later, and then petition for cert. That's four.
I got you. Okay. So, and generally speaking, though, those are rare occasions when any of those things are granted, right?
Yeah, definitely rare. It is a long shot, but one thing that you have going for you, and I would say that it's more likely that you'll be granted en banc review than it is that one of these judges is going to change, or that Judge Schroeder is going to change her mind. One of the things you got going for you is, number one, this is a published decision. So that makes it enhances the likelihood of en banc review. And second, there is a dissent. And so I'm sure that they will give it a close look. And you have a fair chance of having an en banc review. I can't guarantee it, but I think you have a fair chance.
Now, this has taken months, if not years, to get to where it is now. What's the time frame on this?
Well, we file a petition, our petition, in the next, the decision came out 2 days ago, so in the next 12 days. They then decide whether or not, you know, to act upon it, what they're going to do. That may take a while, fairly good while. I don't know exactly what the time frame is, Robert, but probably a couple of months at least.
But
that's a very small amount of time compared to what we've been through so far.
Indeed. Yeah, so that may be coming up. We're talking with Attorney David Beauvais in Berkeley. The issue is the rather arcane issue of, you're acting like a bunch of fascists, sort of mock Nazi salute to the Santa Cruz City Council way back in 2002 that resulted in their saying, leave, and then I said no. I sat down instead and, wanted to continue with the meeting because I had other things I wanted to address on the council agenda when they came up, and I was arrested. What do you think will be the reaction of the Santa Cruz City Council if I repeat this gesture at the next council meeting, if there's a cause to do it?
Well, I don't know, Robert. There's different characters up there now, I suppose. So I don't know that you're going to get the same reaction from the new bunch that you got from the old bunch.
And it's not really a matter of getting a reaction by making an inflammatory gesture. I mean, the council has tried to muzzle me for doing different things. Once I had a sign up there, once I was making a yak-yak motion in response to a council member's speech. They've specifically tailored the rules to cut time when I'm speaking. They've adopted a whole variety of sort of measures to try to make sure that my message is, should we say, truncated, if not that I'm discouraged from coming to council. And indeed, it's had, to some extent, that effect. You yourself, have defended the rights of people at other legislative bodies earlier in your career in Berkeley, right?
Oh, yes, I have. I mean, not in the... I guess I have. I have done that. I had to pause for a minute answering that question.
I think Blue Sky was defended by you in the early 90s.
No, I never represented Blue Sky.
Maybe Carol Denny, perhaps?
But that wasn't so much about First Amendment as it was, litigating on a criminal case.
So perhaps you haven't had a lot of experience with defending the rights of people at trying to speak at legislative bodies per se.
It hasn't come up a lot.
But you felt this was an important case, and you aren't getting paid anything here. You were hoping to make your attorney's fees, but this could be this is many years of many hundred. How many hours of work have you put into this?
I don't know, hundreds of hours.
And how many hours would you estimate the city attorney and his forces have put into it?
I don't know. I heard, quite a while ago that they had spent over $100,000 on this case, but I've never seen any numbers. It's probably something that somebody could do a Public Records Act request and find out. It'd be interesting to know how much taxpayer money they've wasted on that.
So what's the significance of this decision, and why is it important for people, what's this Nazi salute? This is sort of a weird little thing. Why should people be concerned about this?
Well, because in the past, the First Amendment has been vigorously defended, and the exceptions to First Amendment have been very limited, in certain areas, such as using fighting words, which are likely to precipitate immediate violence, or pornography, or obscenity, I should say, and very discreet areas where there is no First Amendment protection. At least that's the way the jurisprudence has evolved. And now we're saying, oh, gee, Nazi salutes aren't going to be allowed either. So what's next? What's the next thing they're going to say is, not decorous enough for public meeting. And I think the effect of something like this chill people expression of ideas in public meetings, and also to dissuade them from attending for fear that they might be arrested for what they say or do.
Well, let me begin to be a devil's advocate, or perhaps mayor's advocate in this case, or maybe city attorney's advocate. What, there have to be, don't you agree that there should be a certain decorum at city council, that there should be a certain set of procedures that a certain gravitas at the legislative level that people shouldn't be allowed to come in swimming suits and, you know, I don't know. I mean, aren't there some ground rules that should be allowed that go beyond somebody's actually stopping the meeting with a disruption that is obviously makes it impossible to continue unless that disruption is stopped? I mean, shouldn't there be some decorum at the city council?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't have any problem with there being decorum at city council meetings. I just think that you have to be careful in letting decorum rules swallow up the First Amendment. The First Amendment is a higher body of law than city council rules. And I don't think it's appropriate to, for example, I don't think there should ever be a dress code to go to a city council meeting.
Should you have to wear clothes to go to a city council meeting?
Well, that would depend on what the rules of the jurisdiction are. I mean, if you have an anti-nudity ordinance, then you know, you could be arrested for violating that.
Well, then what if there were an ordinance about no Nazi salutes in the area? You know, I mean, doesn't that kind of beg the question? I mean, so you think it's simply a question of whether the general law in the community allows for... It may allow for... it's an interesting question. I know that headgear is required for skateboarders. I'm trying to think if a dress code is required in any public places. I know you hear you see the old phrase, no shirt, no shoes, no service, you know, in private places.
Yeah.
All right, so if there's a dress code in the area, then and it let's say, because we actually have had people come to city council bare-breasted who are women. That has happened, and in Santa Cruz there is a... women are permitted to be bare-breasted, although I don't think it's encouraged, and the police will focus on you for doing it. I don't think men are allowed to be, bare-groined or anything of that sort. But I mean, you know, what about other decorum aspects? I mean, should you be allowed to walk around with a sign, "I hate all kikes," and walk into city council meetings, or... You know, have a caricature, have a picture of, you know, Nazis slaughtering Jews. I mean, aren't there some limits to what is appropriate decorum in a city council meeting? And isn't it go beyond what is simply an obvious disruption, which actually stops city council like screaming continuously? Or
the obvious disruption is the easy case, and that's a little different from what we're talking about here. For example, the city council tolerates signs in the chamber. It can't regulate the content of them. So if it were to say something inflammatory like you just alluded to, I don't think they would be able, under the Constitution, to eliminate that. And the same with the... You know, many people find a Nazi salute offensive. And I don't think that just because some people find it offensive that that's the basis for prohibiting that gesture. Because I think if you start going down that road, we're going to have a society where your First Amendment rights depend upon are going to be limited by what you might call a heckler's veto, that somebody doesn't like what you're saying and you can't say it. And I don't think we need to or want to go in that direction. I don't think it's very healthy.
Hmm. We're talking with David Beauvais, a Berkeley attorney who's, you know, been slugging away at this case for 7 years, the case of should an individual be allowed to make a salute to a city council that indicates you're acting like a bunch of Nazis, and then to remain in the room even if a council member doesn't want her or him there. Any more thoughts on this, David? I have another attorney coming on to talk about a case of a guy who was dragged away from the microphone of the board of supervisors. Actually, wasn't dragged away. He spoke, 39 seconds over, and then arrested him later for disrupting a meeting, and then drop the disrupting charge and charge him with resisting arrest, sort of a favorite tactic of some police departments, including San Jose Police Department, with a long story on the misuse of the resisting arrest charge in the Sunday San Jose Mercury News. But anything more you want to say about this?
Yeah, I see that all the time in my practice because I do criminal law. And if a police officer does something wrong, it's the cover charge to make sure that attention is deflected from the police officer's conduct to focus on the person arrested. So it's very common, and it's not just in San Jose, it's universal, for police officers to do something wrong and then cover up their crime by charging the defendant with, you know, either assaulting them or resisting arrest.
I'm going to invite people in the next minute or two to give a call in to 423-4833. Sorry, that's the wrong number. That's actually the number off here. 427-3772. If anyone wants to call and ask a question of you, David, 427-3772, or make a comment that perhaps might elicit a response, but you got to do it quickly because I'm going to have to clear the decks for Tracy Heron. That's not her. She actually has a new name. I think she's taken on a new spouse or a new name, but she's going to be calling in from Arcata, California, about the case of Tad Robinson, who's in jail for he's on hunger strike as well for resisting arrest, although he was actually initially charged with disrupting a meeting because he spoke 39 seconds overtime and then left the microphone, and after that he was arrested. Any final thoughts yourself, David, on this?
I don't have anything more to add, you know, I'll certainly just wait around if anyone wants to call.
Okay. And again, this is an issue that I will probably be hitting the papers pretty soon. It could be, you can write about it on the Sentinel website, which you'll find the company is perhaps not the most pleasant. But we actually, there was a very long thread on this issue when this issue last came up, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago, when you tried to go to trial with us, David, in San Jose. We all tried to, and we weren't successful. So,
nothing from the Sentinel yet?
No, I haven't heard anything from the Sentinel, and I know there no doubt will be something, maybe on page 10 at the bottom, who knows. Although I think it's an important issue. People wonder what this has to do with homeless civil rights, the right of somebody to make a Nazi salute. And it really has to do with the controls a city council can put on dissenting behavior at a city council. That's been my view. What's your thought on that, David?
Oh, I agree. I mean, I agree that you wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for your steadfast resolve to force the council to deal with homeless issues. And that you that this is a situation where they're punishing you for your views.
Now that may be an incoming call. I'm not sure if we got a call waiting here, but I want to thank you for calling, David. And maybe if we get some more questions, well, I'll get back to you.
Okay, take care, Robert.
Thank you, David.
Bye
bye. Bye bye.
And that was David Beauvais of Berkeley, talking about the most recent Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision finding that if you raise your arm in a Nazi salute at a city council meeting, even if you don't say anything and the council doesn't like it, they can have you arrested if you don't leave. Which doesn't sound like a First Amendment, proper application of the First Amendment to me. So it's going to be appealed, and we'll see where that goes. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. And I'm Robert Norris, the name of the show, Bathrop Spears Broadsides. At 7 o'clock, I want to remind you, if you want to get over to the Santa Cruz City Council chambers, it's going to be a planning commission meeting where I guess the second or third item on their agenda is to ban all new medical marijuana facilities, leaving a monopoly in the hands of Greenway and Ken Sampson's club. That's actually the second item on the agenda, so you might want to check that out. I'm expecting shortly to hear from Tracy Heron, who's now Tracy something else, up in Arcata. And let's see if I can give you a little briefing on that. Let's see here. The website that, if you're interested in checking out the current issues in Arcata for homeless folks, is the Plazoid. And the Plazoid is a website run by TAD,
has been up there for, since about 2002, fighting the good fight both in court and on the streets and in on committees and all kinds of other places. And he's incurred the wrath of the mighty. And let's see where we're at here. It's the Plazoid at WordPress.com for those who want to. THEPLAZOID, the Plazoid. And let's see if we can get to that website. Still waiting. And where is it? Oh, Mozilla just crashed. I better put it up again and see if I can find the right place. Tad's got a much better blog than I do. I don't even have a blog. We have a Huff website for those who are interested. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. That's a group that meets every week at the Santa Cruz Sub Rosa Cafe. And it's we meet every 2 hours, 10:30 to 12:30 in the morning. And we're a small group, but we consider trying to raise issues in town either through direct protest or statements to the media. And you can too, if you're interested, or if you want to help out with some of our projects, which involve such things as following court cases, such as the case of Robert Facer and John Keeley. Facer charged under the sleeping ban. Keeley charged as for sitting on a planter. And I'm going to be talking about that in greater detail either later in the show tonight or on Sunday. And I'm having trouble with this computer. It is not helping me out here, and I don't know why. Let's try it again now. Oh, this could be the one. No, this is the earlier edition. Yeah, the Plazoid has a lot of interesting history, exposing poverty pimpery in Arcata, talking about repression of homeless people there. But it's apparently hard to get to the updated place, but I'm hoping to find it here. This could be where I'm at. Yeah, this could be it. Let's see here. Yeah, for those who want to see the issue that got me arrested at Santa Cruz City Council, just go online for Nazi Salute Norse, Google for it, and you'll find the video, and you'll see exactly what kind of so-called disruption was involved. It was actually council members' preference that I be removed from the chamber. And that's the issue there. Interesting stuff on the Plazoid. I finally reached it up in Arcata. Actually, I thought I'd reached it, but I'm at some other weird website. Arcata can be better. You know what? While I'm looking for this, let me take a musical break and give you a chance to smile a little bit, although the comedy could be a little more cutting edge. This is The Capital Steps.
And now, The Capital Steps brings you the newest musical out of Washington, D.C. Please welcome the Washington, D.C. Press Corps!
We all work for the press, and our ethics are strong. We know showing opinions clearly is wrong. Look at us now, will we ever learn? We don't know how, but we started to lose control. There's a fire within my soul. Just one look at the charisma he brings. One more look and we're anointing you king. Oh, Obama Mia, here we go again. My, how can you resist him? Obama Mia, we just knew he'd win. My, how I love to kiss him. Yes, McCain had us fawning, while Barack has us fawning. My, we're a bunch of biased dopes.
Obama, Mia,
he's pro-dream, pro-hope.
My, with Obama, we elope.
the new hit musical Obama Mia. But what will become of his former rival, Senator John McCain?
I'm standing over here. The press could never see me. Don't they want to know about that plumber Joe? Barack had all the cards, 'cause he's young and good looking. And try hard though I might, I'm still uncool and white. So the beginner takes it all, and I'm just standing small. And my voice sounds to some like I've swallowed helium. When we had our debates, my answers got long-winded, 'cause half my time I'd spend calling you my friend. I really need that job. Boy, I could use the salary. I've got outstanding loans on 7 different homes. So now I took a fall, and president might be the only thing I missed on my bucket list. Beginner takes it all.
And how will it end? What will John McCain do next?
So it's so that your votes were low.
You got to show some get up and go.
Maybe you should try dancing, give your wife a tip.
But I might break my hip.
John McCain, we just cannot lie.
You don't seem like a real smooth guy.
Come on, get your groove on, show folks you can dance.
Get me an ambulance.
But you must take a chance. Come on.
Foxtrot is jive.
Ooh, you could be a celebrity.
I'm just like Brittany.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
And that was some vanilla comedy from the Capitol Steps. However, on the line with me, I have... a real freedom fighter as distinguished from a hack politician with a black face, Tracy Rain. Hey, Tracy.
Hi, Robert.
You are an attorney, are you not?
I am. I'm an attorney in Humboldt County.
And are you humble in Humboldt County? Or?
I am.
You are.
Maybe. Try to be. We try to be.
Indeed, indeed. Well, be proud, because I think you are, you've been probably one of the few attorneys who's fighting for the rights of poor people up there, one of them being the infamous Tad... Sometimes called Tad Robinson, but I guess he just likes to be called Tad these days, right?
Yes, he goes by Tad.
Well, I'm looking online, and I was kind of fumbling around trying to find it. I've got there's a section here called Tad's Apology under the plazoid.wordpress.com. I was going to read it, but it's pretty long. You want to summarize why Tad is in the lockup and what's happening with him up there?
Sure, and I should just clarify that I assist Tad in his fighting for himself. I hardly ever end up representing Tad, excuse me, because he's effective at representing himself. But Tad's incarcerated right now in Humboldt County Correctional Facility. I believe he's been there for 11 or 12 days. He's been participating in a hunger strike for 5 days longer than he's been incarcerated. Tad was arrested in January of this year at a Board of Supervisors meeting. He attends those regularly. He dissents. He researches the issues. He dissents to funding and other agenda items that he disagrees with. He does that regularly. And at this particular meeting at the end of January of this year, someone administrative on the Board of Supervisors decided to hit the panic alarm when Tad spoke for 39 seconds longer than an informal three-minute time limit. That person testified that she hit the panic alarm, and she testified that panic alarm, she's trained to hit that alarm under very specific conditions, and she testified as to what those are, and then she testified that those did not exist on the day that she hit the panic alarm.
What does the panic alarm, is it for what, when somebody starts shooting up the room or something? Or?
It's for, her testimony was that it's for when there is threat of death or great bodily injury.
Yeah, but what about the reputations of the poor supervisors? I understand that Tad was criticizing their renewal of an agreement with Barrow Boys Labor Camp, and that might have left their reputation in tatters if he'd gone on.
Yeah, or maybe they were going to be late to lunch or something like that.
Do you know anything about this Barrow Boys Labor Camp that he was talking about? It's one of these private prisons for juveniles, or?
Yeah, I wouldn't profess to know much more than the general public knows. Certainly, I believe Tad researched the issue and knew what he was talking about that day.
He talked about, I guess I'm reading it, his website, it's Profitizing Punishment with Children Involved, and he was angry about it and talking about it, and he was being interrupted, as I understand it, by supervisors at the same time. And this is online, right, the video of his speech before the supervisors?
It is, and I would point out that the irony of that video is if you time the speaker who spoke right after Tad while you're watching these bailiffs who were responding to the panic alarm, essentially escort Tad out of the room, you can time the speaker who comes after him who spoke for 5 minutes.
Well, that's because, see, the bailiffs were busy with Tad. She didn't want to, overburden the bailiffs by pushing the panic alarm again.
I would argue that the Board of Supervisors were too busy enjoying watching Tad be illegally taken out of a public meeting.
Is there any indication of grins of satisfaction on their faces, or?
I can't recall. I was at a Board of Supervisors meeting for a few minutes on Tuesday of this week, and I heard some dissenters speak to the board. And I heard the board make some response, although no apology was forthcoming. I heard county council speak to those who were explaining that they were disappointed in the board's actions that day. No one takes responsibility. Nobody makes any apology, but they at least are acting like they wish they had done something, maybe that they could have done something differently, but they aren't really acknowledging that. They're just less gloating, I would say.
According to the report on the Plazoid, and who's making these reports? Is Tad actually still keeping the blog going from jail?
I can't answer that question. I have no idea.
It says, Supervisor's unapologetic defiance. Supervisor Mark Lovelace called the report of the arrest false and tried to defuse the idea that Tad was physically dragged from the room, though Tad was not dragged from the room. He was indeed escorted out by a bunch of cops when he had every right to be in that room. Lovelace also said Tad's arrest had nothing to do with anything that happened in the meeting room, but failed to explain why then six cops came into the meeting room and told Tad he had to leave the meeting after he was done talking and had left the podium. It had nothing to do with what happened in that meeting.
It's my understanding that Mark Lovelace is under the impression that Tad chest-butted one of the officers in the hallway of the courthouse, but I would submit that no evidence demonstrated that. The police don't even allege that, and Tad, I believe, would vehemently deny that.
Now
who knows Tad knows just would never believe that that occurred.
Now, has Tad been convicted of any violent behavior in the last 5 years that you know of?
No. In fact, I'm aware that he has not been convicted of violent behavior in at least the last, I think, probably 15 years. I have never heard of him ever being convicted of any violent behavior. But I know that he's been charged on several other occasions with this same code section 148, which is resisting, obstructing, or delaying a peace officer, and that on all prior occasions that those charges were brought, he was not convicted of 148. And that evidence was brought to the trial court. And he was really, sort of tricked by the district attorney's office. They initially charged him with 148, and they charged him with a second offense, which they, I believe, is, I don't know the code section.
403, disrupting a public meeting, probably, no?
And when he researched that statute and case law that cite to it, he found a standard which was apparently disrupting a meeting that is not unlawful. So he had done quite a bit of research on that, and then on the very first day of the jury trial, the district attorney dropped the second charge and then won a motion in limine prohibiting any evidence of anything that occurred in the Board of Supervisors meeting to the jury. So really the entire incident was taken completely out of context, and the jury mostly heard only what happened in the hallway afterwards, which was also not violent, and Tad argued, and I would agree, was not resisting, obstructing, or delaying. In fact, the officers who testified at trial, and Tad himself testified, that he was saying, arrest me or let me go free. Arrest me or let me go free.
And they were trying to shove him along without telling him he was under arrest.
That's correct. They were trying to shove him along out of the courthouse, and he was demanding his lawful right to be in a public meeting.
It's interesting. You know, I had exactly the same experience in 2005 when I stood at the microphone, and Captain Clark started putting me in a pain compliance hold, and I kept saying, am I under arrest? Am I under arrest? And he refused to say anything. He kept shoving me along. Finally, the mayor said, you're under arrest. And I said, fine, I walked out. So I sympathize directly with Tad's situation. They did not, however, take me to trial on that, perhaps because it was televised so broadly and it was so clearly something at the at the public microphone. So in the actual situation, Tad's resisting was simply was the testimony that he resisted after he'd been told he was under arrest, or he should have known he was under arrest simply because he was being shoved along, or on what basis, what was the claim of the district attorney that he was resisting?
There were several claims, I believe, several of which Tad would agree were factual, and several that he disputed at trial on the facts. I remember that one officer testified that he... made bodily, moved his body in such a way that indicated delaying him after he was told he was under arrest. All the rest of the testimony was as to prior to anyone telling him he was being arrested, even according to the witnesses that the people brought.
Were there any non-police witnesses to this?
Yes, Tad was not permitted to present them because the conduct that they observed occurred inside the Board of Supervisors chambers, and that evidence was precluded. So there were two people who know that Tad was no longer speaking at the podium at the time that the first officer entered the room, and then there were, I believe, two administrative folks from the Board of Supervisors who testified who Tad got to say all that evidence about the panic alarm, but it didn't seem to influence the jury.
Let me ask, so Tad was just sitting in the room when the cops came in, or was he leaving the room? Did the cops come up and demand he leave? What happened in that situation? What was the chain of events?
I'm going to let you talk to JD about some of those details. He is a member of Tad's defense team and probably knows a little bit more about those reports on the plazoid, and I think that there was an article in the Arcata Eye recently.
Sure. I don't mean to...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't mean to micro... examine the whole thing, because I think it's, you know, it's, I mean, it's, maybe I should talk you into him later, or he can certainly talk on the air if he wants, but I want to make, you know, draw some broader issues. Tad has been on a hunger strike, for 6 days or so before he went into jail, or?
I believe it was 5 days prior, and I only would introduce JD because I feel like I get a little bit of undeserved attention simply because I'm an attorney, but really JD's been
well,
visiting
Tad. Let's put on JD then, Ms. Attorney.
Great. Okay, great. Hold on just one moment.
Thanks a lot.
JD.
Hello.
Is this the non-attorney, JD?
Definitely.
Excellent. So, you probably heard, you've heard the whole conversation or some of it anyway, at least her side of it.
Yeah, I heard I heard a bit of it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to give the audience a picture of what happened when Tad was arrested. Was he sitting in a seat trying to listen to the Board of Supervisors when some guys with guns and uniforms came in and grabbed him, or what happened there?
Well, I wasn't actually there, so I can only tell you what Tad has told me happened, which you probably already heard, maybe?
No, although I may have read his website, but what's your understanding of what happened based upon his account?
Yeah, my understanding is that, and from watching the video, too, you can see he talks, and right as he's wrapping it up, Chairperson Jimmy Smith starts talking over him, telling him to have a seat, like basically shouting him down.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tad tells him he's not going to take it, you know, for, I don't know, maybe 10, 20 seconds.
39 seconds overtime.
That's over the 3 minutes.
Right.
I don't know.
But that wasn't strictly enforced. It was already mentioned the next speaker spoke for 5 minutes. And is that it?
Yeah.
So it was differential. Did he then go to sit down, or was he then standing when the cops came, as far as he remembers?
Yeah, he finished speaking, and you can see him. He turns around and walks back to his seat. The next speaker's, I think, even up at the podium ready to speak. And the cops come into the room, and he leaves with them.
Did they tell him he was under arrest, or did he just leave with them to chat with them? Did he want to have join the police force? Why did he leave with them?
Yeah, my understanding is they just wanted him to leave the room. But what I was going to say is that I timed it because one of the police reports says that it took him like 4 to 5 minutes to leave the chambers. But you can clearly see within 18 seconds he's out of the room. And
it just seemed like an eternity to the police department.
Yeah.
So you were at the trial as well?
No, I've only come down to visit him just a little while before he started going to jail, before he turned himself.
Now, why did he begin this hunger strike? What issue was he trying to raise?
Well, there's all these issues that are always ongoing. And him going to jail is like, it's just, one more thing where suddenly the spotlight's on him. But the sort of injustices that that resulted in Tad getting sent to jail, like the injustice that he felt compelled to speak about at the Barrow Boys private youth detention facility / work camp, boot camp place, and the sort of biased attitude of these public government meetings and selective enforcement by cops. And all that's routine, and it keeps the jails full and the probation officers busy. And so he's trying, I think, I can only... Yeah.
I mean, often,
but roughly, he's trying to just bring attention to all these things.
Well, often a hunger strike will have a specific objective. In other words, I will continue this hunger strike until such time as A, B, and C are met. Is this what Tad's doing or not?
I think I don't know exactly why, but on Geronimo's sign, he's been doing this vigil, a mobile vigil in Arcata and Eureka. It says that it's a 40-day hunger strike. I don't know if Tad said that or not.
A 40-day hunger strike, but with what objective? Is there a particular change that he's looking for that is concrete and that can be demanded and implemented?
Mm-hmm. Well, he spoke at the last supervisor's meeting before he went to jail. He said that he was demanding of the supervisors that they take responsibility for their role in the commission of these injustices because they approve the funding of like things like the Barrow Boys youth camp.
Tell us a little bit about the Barrow Boys Youth Camp.
Well, you know, I've never been there myself, I have to admit. Let's see. From what I understand, it's a private-run place. It's kind of confusing when you try and look at it on the Internet, because it always seems like some of their documents are on Del Norte County letterhead and stuff, but they have a business profile that says it's a private company. So I don't know. I'm confused about that. But
this is sort of a private prison for juveniles, yes?
Yeah, but it's not just a prison. It's
work camp?
A work camp. And if you go to their website, you see that they do Forest Service contracts and you know, other jobs that I assume they get paid for, but the kids don't get paid. So,
but it's good. It's good training, right, JD?
Well, it's good training for the sort of slavery that we're all expected to.
Yeah, wage slavery has been a tradition for many generations.
Uh huh. Well, you know, they get food and shelter, so I guess it's a.
Yeah. What are they complaining about?
Yeah.
So, you say you visited Tad in jail. He's about the 15th or 20th day of a hunger strike? Where is he at with us now?
Yeah, I think he's about 15 days into his hunger strike. Oh, but one more thing I wanted to mention about
sure.
Barrow Boys before
sure.
we move on
mm-hmm.
is that there's a wrongful death lawsuit. I don't know whether it's, you know, if it's been resolved or not, and the supervisors didn't speak to it when they were asked, so either they don't know or...
So the supervisors renewed the contract of Barrow Boys?
Yeah, it was a consent item, so it's like just kind of rubber stamped through the system.
Now, up in Arcata, are you allowed to remove an item from the consent agenda and talk about it individually if you want?
Yeah, this is actually in Eureka, but yeah.
In Eureka. We can't do that in Santa Cruz. You have to get the permission of a city council member to do that.
Oh.
It's even worse down here than it is up there. Although, you know, that's thanks to Mike Rotkin. Actually, that's thanks to Ryan Coonerty and now Cynthia Matthews, our last two mayors. We're talking with J.D. up in Arcata, who's just giving us sort of some briefing for Tad, who would speak for himself, but he's in jail, and I guess they aren't letting him get any incoming calls, right?
Yeah, they don't take phone calls for prisoners.
Now, he refused probation. They said, we'll let you go if you'll be on probation for 2 years, right?
That's my understanding. I wouldn't take it either.
Why wouldn't you take probation? You'll be out. You'll be able to, you know, sit at your favorite restaurant and lie in the sun and, you know... Who knows what else, man?
Yeah, maybe, but you'd spend 2 years of living even more in fear of the random violence of the police state coming down on your head with, you know, no even facade of rights. I mean, I wouldn't say we necessarily have rights now because they always come down to some little condition or extenuating circumstance where, say, the cop, you know, we have a right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. But if a cop feels threatened, you know, he or she can still pat you down for weapons and detain you. And if you don't let them do that, then, well, they can do whatever they want because you're, you know, disobeying their authority.
Resisting arrest, like Tad was, apparently.
Yeah.
Or at least they convicted him. Were you at the trial, the Tad's trial, or not?
No, I wish I would have been. You know, I thought I had another place to be. But if I'd known, you know, there was any chance he was going to lose, I thought it was a for sure thing that was going to get thrown out. It just seemed so ridiculous.
Did a lot of people support Tad in the community or not?
I would say so. I mean, of course, I know my friends more than I know other people, and my friends support Tad.
Now, are you houseless yourself?
Well, I sleep in houses.
What I mean to say is, do you have a residence that you rent that's pretty permanent, or... A place that you're staying with a friend.
Well, it's not going anywhere. It's a broken down van in a driveway.
Oh,
the fact that it's in a driveway, you know, it offers me quite a bit of security because if you're just on the street and your registration's expired, you know, you can get towed at any minute.
Now, can you, in Santa Cruz, you're only allowed to sleep in a driveway in a vehicle for 3 nights per calendar month. What's the rule up in Arcata?
I don't know. You know, it's one of those things where I didn't really care what the rules said. I was going to sleep in the best place I could find.
But the police haven't hassled you for doing that.
No, I mean, we've had a little trouble with our landlord. But this isn't in Arcata, but I did live in a van in Arcata for a long time, and eventually my vehicle did get towed because the registration had expired, and of course I couldn't renew the registration without insurance.
But you weren't were you on private property or on public property?
No, I was on the streets.
Right, but see, in Santa Cruz we have a law on private property that you can't be there for more than 3 calendar days per month overnight unless...
That sounds fair.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, we don't need to. You only need really a. I think sleep is highly overrated. You know, it's.
Yeah, I mean, you can get so much more done when you're.
Yeah, people should keep on rolling along. I've got some attempt to really help the homeless get more industrious by eliminating sleep for 27 days a month, at least in terms of this particular law. So, how can people help Tad? Can they write to him? Can they email him? What do you suggest they do?
Oh, but he'd love getting letters. To write to him, you write to his legal name or whatever you want to call it, which is Theodore Robinson, and then you put care of Humboldt County and in correctional in quotation marks facility, and it's 826 4th Street, 826 4th Street, Eureka, California, 95501, I think. I don't really know. But, yeah, that, and, he has a blog that's been kept up by a ghost blogger while he's in jail, and that's theplazoid.wordpress.com, and you can, you know, learn more about what's going on, the Barrow Boys Camp, the judges Ciavarelli and Conahan, who pled guilty to jailing children for money, as a Reuters article.
I think I read that one, yeah.
It was cold.
And Ted is in good health, or he's getting thinner? What's happening with old Ted? Is he?
Well, he's not necessarily getting. I mean, maybe he's gaining weight. I've heard that. He's doing great. He's high spirits. Every time I go in there and see him, he is the most mentally healthy person in the room, in both sides of the bulletproof glass. He's same old Ted. He's happy, smiling.
When's he due out?
Huh?
When's he due out?
13th, or I think maybe like midnight on the 12th.
Of December or?
November.
November, so he should be out fairly soon.
Yeah, he's got, a week and a half left. I think when I saw him yesterday, he was saying he was at the halfway mark or something. So.
Huh. So, tell us a little bit about Tad as an activist for the rights of homeless people. What has he done or not done, or what is he known for up in Arcata and Eureka?
Oh, gosh. But he's a lot of different things to different people. When I first met him, I was living outside and kind of would spend some time in the downtown area. And I met him because he was like a level-headed person that, I could talk to for a minute. And he's very self-sufficient. He takes care of himself. When I met him, he had a bike trailer and a bicycle, and he would do recycling out of dumpsters and stuff. And would do pretty well, and all the recycling he was doing was recyclable stuff that was headed to a landfill. He'd take it out of a garbage can, I guess some people might set stuff aside for him. He had,
this was a couple years ago, or?
Yeah, it was a couple years ago, and he'd showed me how to patch the inner tube on a bike and some cool spots, to like go hang out and run around with Grizz. Grizz is his dog companion. He's like part St. Bernard. He's a big old guy. I guess before that, when he showed up in town, I think he'd camped out in a marsh area, a bird sanctuary, and the cops had chased him out, and so he set up a tent or something on the plaza, I think in the wintertime. I wasn't there, I only heard the stories, but just to protest the way homeless people were treated by the cops, because, people are people, and anybody can end up finding themselves sleeping in a tent at some point in town or in the outskirts of town or whatever, and you just got to think about how you would want to be treated. I think Tad tries to treat people the way he would want to be treated.
He was on a commission for a while that supposedly looked into homeless concerns, services, rights, and so forth, but I guess he and others quit that commission when they thought it was essentially bogus, as I remember.
Yeah, I think a big emphasis on the supposedly looked into the rights and well-being of homeless people. That was the Homeless Task Force, also more popularly among the homeless known as the Homeless Task Farce. It was the city of Arcata putting together a little, task force to
talk about the issues.
Yeah, I guess there's a lot of complaints, mainly from downtown business owners, about homeless people. And they blamed them for shitting on their doorsteps and pissing and hanging out and being dirty and being.
Are there any 24-hour bathrooms in Arcata?
No, I'm not aware of any 24-hour bathroom. They have the courthouse has a bathroom. It's definitely not 24 hours. I remember one of the flyers I saw in Arcata was for No Shit Sunday. It was like a quarter sheet that people were handing out, I guess, at Farmer's Market or something, that was asking Arcadians to, in solidarity with homeless people, not take a shit on Sunday because there was no public bathrooms. So there's no place a homeless person could legally relieve themselves. And so in solidarity, Arcadians were being asked to just hold it for a day.
Well, maybe what they should do is simply deposit their shit at the Board of Supervisors or the Arcata City Council.
Yeah.
You know, as in a way of suggesting, wrapped up in bags to be presented for proper disposal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose they might it might be considered indecorous behavior at City Council or Board of Supervisors.
Well, I don't know. They have their hands in shit all the time there.
That sounds like a lot of shit. JD, we're talking with JD up in Arcata, who's a support team for Tad, who's in jail, due out on November 11th. Is that right?
13th.
November 13th. And I guess Tracy's also still hanging out. What's happening? You can either tell me or she can tell me about what's cooking with the latest legal challenges to sleeping ban laws in Eureka and Arcata. Anything you want to talk about or she wants to talk about?
Well, I can mention that a bunch of folks are tonight out sleeping on City Hall. I guess this was going to be their first night of doing that. I'm not really sure what the whole plan for the future is. You know, Tracy and Tad fight as many camping tickets as they can. She could probably tell you more about the specifics if you'd like to hear that. I can see if she's available.
Sounds good. And if anybody wants to call in and ask questions, you can,
427-3772.
Yes?
I couldn't hear you.
That's okay. I was just giving a number for people to call if they want to ask you or Tracy questions. 427-3772 is the call-in number here. 831 is the area code if you're calling from out of the area. You still there?
Yep. Okay. I'm still here, and Tracy says she'll talk to you about the latest legal stuff.
Sounds good.
Like.
And, Jed, anything you want to conclude with? Or I know we've suggested people want to leave a message for Tad. They can do so, of course, directly by going to the plazoid.wordpress.com or by contacting the Humboldt County Correctional Facility, Theodore Robinson, 826 4th Street, Eureka, 95501. And if that's a little fast for you, just leave a message on the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I'll get back to you with the full address. Hey, Tracy Rain, if I'm not mistaken. You're back.
I am.
So I was asking J.D., there's apparently some kind of protest on the steps or the plaza, City Hall. What's this about? Are these ragamuffins making a spectacle of themselves?
Tad's fans are all ragamuffins.
Go ahead.
Tad, someone who believes in Tad's hunger strike and is strongly opposed to what happened to Tad has been staying day and night at the plaza and has a great big sign, really bigger than most standard-sized doors, indicating Tad's incarceration and hunger strike. I think it says Free Tad. I've seen it once. It's an impressive action.
Uh-huh. Is there a demand that Tad has for his hunger strike, or is it simply just sort of a... Usually, you know, when Gandhi went on a hunger strike, he wanted something particular done, like British get out of India or something, you know.
Tad does have at least one demand that I know of. He's asking that the Board of Supervisors pass a penal code statute. I think it's 647A, subsection B. And it gives officers authorization to... It actually might mandate officers citing folks for camping to put the alleged violator in their car and take them to a shelter.
But do shelters exist?
In Arcata, there's a shelter. It's actually not in the city of Arcata. The conditional use permit allowing it to operate allows it to have 11 beds. And it operates outside of the city in the county rather than within city limits. There is no shelter space available in Arcata right now. In Eureka, there's limited shelter space through the Eureka Mission. Some of our houseless folks complain about the hours and the strictness of the rules, but certainly most of them complain that they're forced to practice a specific religion in order to either eat or sleep at that facility.
Well, the heathens must be brought to heel.
That's right. there just aren't enough people fighting against those types of policies.
So he's asked that the new code statute, 647A, subsection B, require officers to take a person to a shelter bed before giving them a camping ticket?
You'll have to get Dad to call in when he's no longer incarcerated. I'm just not as familiar with the statute. And it's written. I mean, Tad didn't write the statute. It's part of a model penal code that I think you probably could find. Huh. I believe subsection A, it's 647A, subsection A. I believe that subsection authorizes voluntary, if the person, the alleged violator, asks to be taken to a shelter, authorizes an officer to take them. Subsection B actually would mandate it in situations, I think, where they're being ticketed or maybe prior to being ticketed.
Uh-huh. Now, how does this I know you've got various cases yourself where you're defending sleeping tickets and maybe even seeking an injunction based upon a Murguia motion where you're trying to show that there's selective enforcement and a pattern and practice of discriminatory enforcement against homeless people or houseless people outside with these camping ordinance stuff. Where's that going, and how's that involved?
Well, I'm not seeking an injunction yet. I have considered bringing a civil lawsuit to get an injunction to prohibit enforcement of these camping bans in Eureka and Arcata. I have a few cases right now that are actually against California State University. We have Humboldt State University up here. A guy who got cited for sleeping in the library at the college nearby. What I'm doing is I've brought a motion to dismiss these infractions for constitutional reasons, one of which is cruel and unusual punishment as applied to involuntarily homeless folks. The second constitutional argument is that these anti-sleeping ordinances violate people's fundamental right to travel. And the third argument is that they are vague and overbroad. And Eureka has the most limited application of an anti-sleeping statute. Arcata criminalizes camping and then defines camping as using a space for living quarters or temporarily occupying a space, which is one of the broadest definitions I've ever seen.
It sounds like that applies to anybody, anywhere, at any time.
It could be anywhere. It doesn't even have to involve any type of camping activity.
How old is this law? Has it been around for a while?
I believe it was early, the early part of this decade. And it was enacted with three or four other ordinances that are meant to target houseless folks. Tad and I, before he went to jail, were working on trying to get a record of the legislative intent at the time that the anti-sleeping ordinance was passed. Because the motion for discovery that we currently have pending, it's meant to demonstrate by showing the addresses of the people who were cited in the 3 years prior to our clients, that since all of those people are homeless or transient, at whatever's written on the ticket, we want to show a discriminatory effect or a discriminatory intent. But in order to win a discovery motion like that, you have to already be able to show a discriminatory effect and or discriminatory intent. And no opposing law enforcement agencies or city attorneys will admit that that they're only citing involuntarily houseless folks for these ordinances.
So the mere evidence that that's happening is not sufficient to show intent. It's all just a big coincidence.
Apparently.
Well, that can happen. I mean, they may just happen to be citing people with homeless addresses. Why are you so paranoid?
I can see the circular aspect of the argument, but I can't seem to overcome it in court. So I'm actually appearing tomorrow at 2:00 on discovery motions for two clients, one of whom has 5 tickets. 4 of those are at HSU. And I'm arguing against the city attorney of Arcata and general counsel for California State University, who is in Long Beach. And these things are always a lot easier when Tad is around to support me and sometimes pass me notes when I miss an argument in court.
You might want to get in touch with Glenn Maurer. I may have mentioned him before in earlier phone calls. Glenn was the main public defender of Santa Barbara, who, after he retired, spent 5 years successfully defending homeless folks concerned with anti-sleeping ordinances, concerned with trying to live in their vehicles. He won some cases, which if you look up Street Spirit newspaper and some of the articles I've written, you'll find that he established the right to sleep in your vehicle, in your RV in Santa Barbara, the right to not go to a religious shelter because it's a form of discrimination. He won that at a local level, I guess the Court of Appeals. And he also he's got a dozen tricks, as you know. It's always an individual case is always, it's a matter of finding the right twist to the case, although it's obviously constitutional arguments are important. And the latest attack, of course, as you probably know, in Laguna Beach and Santa Barbara and Santa Monica and the attacks on the sleeping bans there, which are being done part by the ACLUs. I wish our ACLU were doing something, but it's not.
I wish ours were, too.
Really. Is using the disabled concern, that people who are outside who are disabled, these kinds of laws criminalize them and violate federal statutes around the rights to people under the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a new approach.
That is a great approach, and it works better than what we've been taking because of the Tobe
decision
case, specifically declining to accept that houseless folks are members of a class that's discriminated against.
The other thing is to use the necessity defense endlessly. In other words, if you set up a kind of a blanket or what do we call it, boilerplate necessity defense for every defendant who comes into court, it would seem to me, although it is a defense you have to establish, it might tire the courts out, although I guess these guys have an endless cash fund, don't they? I don't know.
That's basically what brought me to the constitutional arguments I've been making and why the disability argument should be successful, because, we can fight them one by one on the necessity defense, and we've won 3 or 4 here that way, but the police are certainly citing more than 3 or 4 people, per night on these statutes. In the one case where I did not win the constitutional motion, I was not inclined to bring the necessity defense because at that point I wanted my client to be found guilty just so that I would have standing to appeal the dismissal of the constitutional motion.
Right.
So, yeah. I didn't bring the necessity defense in that case, but the judge in that case applied it anyway and found my client to be factually innocent based on the necessity.
Similarly, that's been done here by Judge Simons, although we do have a case which is now on appeal. Yesterday, actually, our Commissioner Kim Baskett found a man guilty of violating the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz, and the city attorney was there in all his glory to argue about that. I'll be talking about it more on Sunday. For those who want to tune into the show, I'll be playing the actual court proceeding in a rare example of attempting to be nice while at the same time churning out fines for the city. Kim Baskett allowed us to tape record for broadcast, which other
judicial officers have refused to do recently for us. We're talking with Tracy Rain up in beautiful, is it Eureka you're at?
I am in Eureka.
Well, yeah, what's happening in the South Spit Jetty? Anybody showing up for a nostalgic reunions 10 years later?
I have no idea,
you know,
Robert.
The South Spit Jetty, of course, is a place where there was massive homeless encampments till they were driven out by bogus health concerns about 11 years ago. Are you familiar with any of that, or probably not?
Not a whole lot, and I wasn't here back then.
Well, you just have to get into your history books there, Tracy. Well, listen.
I am encouraged, though, to learn about Glenn Maurer. And when I was in law school, I was in San Diego, and I lived in my vehicle for over 2 years. And it was 97 to 99, and that's actually when I heard about when I first heard about these ordinances, which were criminalizing sitting, sleeping, or lying in public places, and I think that those were initially happening in Santa Barbara.
And actually, San Diego, as you probably know, that has Robert Scott Dreyer, who's successfully won the Spencer settlement down there, which is even better than the Jones settlement in Los Angeles. For those who are following the show regularly, you may remember Jones' settlement overturned the law in Los Angeles and said you can't sit, sleep, or lie on sidewalks in Los Angeles. Now that's you can if you're 10 feet from a building and until they build 1,250 units of supportive housing. But in San Diego, Dreyer was able to successfully get them to make a much broader application so that they can't take you away unless there's a shelter space available at any time, and particularly at night. So it's you might want to get in touch with him, too. If you give me an email, I'll try to send you those folks. I think I've done this before, but who knows? Doing it again might not be a bad idea.
Great.
I'm at rnorse3@hotmail.com.
I think I have that.
Yeah.
Robert, I'm going to have to get going.
Hey, me too, and thank you for all the time you put in both on the air and, you know, in court and, you know, out there on the streets. So.
No, thank you so much for presenting Tad's information.
Yay. Tell him hello. Thanks.
Okay, have a good night.
Bye-bye. And that was Tracy Rain, also known as Tracy Heron, up in Arcata. I hope folks got something out of that. It's about the legal struggle against the sleeping bans up there. That has some relationship to us down here. We're coming into the winter months, and the city attorney is still making the preposterous and false argument that there is adequate shelter in Santa Cruz. He's actually doing this implicitly. That's why how he got Robert Facer essentially found guilty. He refused to allow evidence that there was inadequate shelter, but he refused to present evidence that there was adequate shelter, even though he knows that's, I would assume, as a knowledgeable person who has some gets regular information of some sort from the Homeless Services Center, and we've heard that from the Homeless Services Center former director, Doug Loisel, there's no shelter tonight for people who want to walk into even a spot on the floor out of the Homeless Services Center. There won't be until mid-November, and then, you know, you'll have to go through a process of getting not necessarily on a waiting list, but certainly in a line. You have to be one of the first 75 to 100 to show up. You'll have to meet certain requirements to get on the bus to the Winter Armory shelter. And the fact that the city attorney and the Kim Baskett, the commissioner who regularly hears these sleeping ban tickets, refuses to acknowledge this reality and treat it as a fact, or even take judicial notice of it. We're going to be talking about that more on Sunday, but it's a disgrace. To me, it seems a form of conspiracy against homeless people with the intent to uphold power for the police department to regularly roust whatever homeless person they want to roust and maintain this as a, quote, useful tool for officers to use to search, interrogate, or move along any homeless person they want. And that is just plain simply wrong. The Planning Commission meeting may still be going on. That's the meeting that it's being held at City Council Chambers, and it's concerning itself with more reefer madness type stuff, where they're going to ban any more distribution centers, any more medical marijuana shops in Santa Cruz, even though there is, from what I've heard, a clear need for them. It's a business opportunity for people who want to do it. And I know some people don't like that idea because they regard medical marijuana simply as medicine that should only be available to people who are sick. I think it should be available to anybody and everybody who wants it. But certainly there are stringent safeguards in place for people who are sick. And if it brings in more business to the city from out of the area, the people who need it, that seems to me to be a public service. And to get selfish and fearful about it by saying, well, let other people open up marijuana shops, seems to me both short-sighted and bigoted. And that is what we're facing tonight and we'll be facing at the city council meeting soon as they pass these new laws that criminalize all new medical marijuana dispensaries in Santa Cruz. So I'm going to play a little from this, a little more from the Obama Mia. Again, my apologies. I should have something a little better to play, but I was preoccupied with preparing for these interviews, and I don't know how good the preparation was, but I thank anybody who listened, and I thank folks who have an interest in these issues, and encourage you to, if you want to do some legal research, if you want to provide some help technically, if you want to write some letters, if you want to assist in computer website work, HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, needs your help. You can give a call to the HUF line, 423-HUF, 423-4833, and I will call you back. So, also, I'll be having an interview with Doug Loisel, who, as you know, was fired as the Homeless Service Center Director and is now back in Los Angeles. I spoke to him by phone about his thoughts around his tenure on the Homeless Services Center as Director, and I'm going to play that interview, and that'll be happening on Sunday between 9:30 and 1, as well as some other street interviews. I'm still in search of some of the interviews which are now currently lost interviews. If anybody sees a white tote bag around town with my notebook in it, please give a call to the HUF line. I could use it, 423-HUF. I'm looking for it. And I do appreciate everybody's listening who was listening and anybody who wants to get back to me by phone for more information or to volunteer any kind of help again. 423-HUF is the number. Coming up next, it's From the Cream to the Dregs with Uncle Dennis. He will be in the studio shortly, playing some cranky old music from the 60s and 70s, which will be hauntingly familiar to some of you. And I'll be back on Sunday with more of the same, and possibly you will too. So thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides.
Ladies and gentlemen, Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. Thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen. It is such a pleasure to be here tonight. I am so delighted and happy to be here to introduce to you our new president, Barack. Oh, who am I kidding? This is my year, people. It should have been mine. That being said, please help me welcome President Barack Hussein Obama.
Hillary, thank you for that enthusiastic introduction. And welcome to my administration. I hope you're happy with your new position.
Well, wait a minute. Did I hear someone say there's a new position? Yeah. Why haven't I heard about this?
No, Bill. See, what Barack is saying is that since he gets to be the leader of the free world, I should be happy being what so many women before me have been. A secretary.
Actually, what I was saying is that Hillary will play an important role in my administration. I've invited her to sit on my right hand.
So much for the circulation in your right hand. Hey, Barack, by the way, I understand that when you were taking the oath of office, John Roberts stumbled on the word faithfully. kind of reminds me of my wedding vows.
Well, now it's time to look to the future. I'm hoping that as a member of my cabinet, Hillary will support my enormous stimulus package.
Yeah, good luck with that. But hey, look, you know, since the three of us are here, and I mean, I know that's not the good kind of three-way, but perhaps we could all work together for the good of the party.
Ebony
and ovaries is the ticket to liberals' destiny. Just like Alex Rodriguez, yes sir, we've got chemistry. Hill, you know, folks say that he's untested wherever he goes. He'll need lots of help and expertise to get things done from day one in his new White House.
His resume's thin,
like an Olsen twin. Bill, you did campaign for me. Is there some way to thank you personally? Just how soon can you send her somewhere, please, that's overseas? What could possibly go wrong now? I guess we soon will see.
Thank you.
Good evening. I am Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, and I am here tonight to honor myself. As you're undoubtedly aware, I was appointed to the position of Prime Minister by my hand-picked successor as President, Dmitry Medvedev. It was such a shock. I had no idea he was even thinking of me, I must say. But nevertheless, I do accept on my own behalf. And I would also like to further congratulate President Medvedev for a smooth transitional period that resulted in no additional deadness on his part. I find it comforting that I am in so much agreement with the new president, but perhaps it would be better to tell you about this in a song. Gory. Prove too much for this man.
Too much for this man. So he's thinking.
So I think I might have to go. Oh.
He said he's going.
I said I'm going back to find.
Going back to find.
What's left of Cold War. A war I left behind. Not that long ago. Oh no, yes I'm leaving.
Leaving
on a midnight raid to Georgia.
Leaving on a midnight raid.
Yeah. Said I'm going back.
Going back to tour.
And maybe start
a war. Maybe take a little tour. Who knows, you might just start a war.
And he'll be with me.
You know he will.
On my midnight raid to Georgia.
Midnight raid to Georgia. Woo-hoo.
They'd rather live in my world than not be living in yours.
World.
Yeah, U.S. is dreaming. Oh, that I won't go too far.
He is not a czar, he won't go too far.
But George Bush will find the hard way. That dreams don't always
dreams come true. Always
oh,
come
no,
true.
They don't.
Ooh.
So take a look in my eyes, and you ooh can see right down in my soul that you're never gonna stop. No, never gonna stop anything that I might do. Oh, no, you won't. Or I'll be leaving. On a midnight plane to George Bush.
On a midnight plane.
Yeah, I'll try to convince the U.S.
going back to
that. I still can fix this mess.
To the U.S. See if there's a way to fix this.
Yes,
mess.
I'll pay a visit, yes.
We know you will.
And try to explain to George Bush.
Even Annie will explain to George Bush.
IQ. That I don't mean the Georgia that is in the U.S. No, I'm not talking about your Georgia. Yeah, I don't mean that in Georgia.
And that winds up Bathrobe Spears Broadsides for this week. Well, I guess not quite. Robert will be back Sunday at 9:30 in the morning unless he comes in earlier and interrupts Thomas's show.
Abbreviated show, we might add. Thank you, Dennis.
Anyway, any of these yours, Robert?
No, those aren't mine. I can see
it. How about...
That's not mine either.
That's not yours either. Okay, well... The studio is accumulating random detritus, but that's pretty normal. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to welcome you to a show called From the Cream to the Dregs. And let me get my bass tones in here. Yeah, we're going to be playing rock and roll from the 60s and 70s up until 11 o'clock with an interruption at 9 for the Earth First Update environmental news for you. And at 10 o'clock, the Earth First Update. All of that right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1, www.freakradio.org. And, of course, we can always use donations.
Thank you.
wash your whip and you're driving me bad. Your love for me got to be real. For you to know just how I feel. A love for real, not fade away. Love is love and not fade away.